Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm here with my friend Brian Chu. You might know him from the From the New World podcast and Substack. We've had some conversations. He's doing something new now besides writing. He's founded a think tank called the Alliance for the Future. So, Brian, welcome. Tell me about this and what exactly you're going to be doing in DC from now on.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here, finally making the transition from online writing to, you know, actually doing something. So this is something I noticed the last time I was in DC. People in general, and especially lawmakers, have a very low resolution understanding of machine learning. They'll think of it as, you know, just ChatGPT, and they won't even have a good idea about what ChatGPT is, how it works, or, you know, not even any of the technical stuff, but just what it's like to use ChatGPT. Like, they haven't used it that much at all.
Mm.
And this leads to an environment that is sort of really based off of sentiments, really based off of assumptions, for better or worse. Right? This includes some people who would agree with my policy prescriptions. But at the end of the day, I think that policy should be made based on reality, based on how people are actually using machine learning on the day-to-day, and just giving lawmakers and staff a very basic understanding of that is our goal here. And right now, from all of the conversations I've had, from, you know, finding as many people to work together with as possible, there's just a very stunningly few people with any sort of technical knowledge and a basis in reality. And that's, you know, that's what we're trying to change.
Yeah. So it's a 501c4. That means you can influence policy, right? That's your hope.
Yeah, that is precisely the goal. If we influence no policy, well, it depends what policy there is to influence, right? But if we have no influence, then I would say that's not a great time.
Yeah, right. So you're going to be like living in DC.
Yeah, right? I just made the move from around a month ago.
Mm. And what's your daily basis? What's your work going to be on a daily basis?
So far, it's been a lot of meetings, a lot of the arguments, the announcements, the policy proposals, the descriptions and explainers. I spent basically 2 years writing, right? Not all of it was about machine learning, certainly, but those technical arguments were already out there. So this week, it's been a lot of organizational stuff, and the last few weeks as well. Meeting with people, doing, you know, pretty basic logistics, setting up group chats, setting up all of the coordination we need to actually, you know, run Alliance for the Future, and to fundraise, and so on and so forth. So that's what my work looks like right now. In the future, what we're looking at is hosting more events, coordinating with staff, coordinating to try to testify in front of Congress, so on and so forth.
Yeah. And so are policymakers in Washington, are they sort of receptive? Do you find them that they're looking for enlightenment, or are they, not really?
Yeah. So mostly it's through staff. It's very hard, especially as a starting organization, to directly talk to any elected representatives. But yeah, the staff are very receptive. They see AI, especially in the current cycle, they see AI in the headlines. This is something that they want to do something about, they want to learn about, that they see as something that could really have a high potential in the future. So I think we've started at a good time.
Yeah, that's great. Are you, so people know where you are sort of in the intellectual landscape. The Alliance for the Future is bullish on AI. You do not worry about the alignment problem. You do not think it's going to kill us all. You want the
technology. So many of these projections are just based on a complete detachment from reality. I heard Robin Hanson put it greatly on a podcast before, that people see the exponential increase in abilities, but don't see the exponential increase in difficulty. And every field is like this. You know, you invent better tools for observing particles in physics, for example. You invent ever better tools. Sure, you get more precise measurements, but then the problems get harder. And now we're stuck on string theory. And in fact, you see this in literally every field across history. And this idea, you know, this kind of like blindness, it's like a three-year-old learning how to do addition. I don't know if three-year-olds learn addition. Maybe it's like a six-year-old. Six-year-old learns addition. And, you know, he just thinks himself, you know, you're just adding numbers. They just keep on getting bigger. It will never stop. And then, you know, maybe they turn a year older and they learn how to subtract. This is the phase between, you know, the 6-year-old and the 7-year-old. It's just so silly.
Yeah. So, yeah. So in theory, you believe that AI. So this is against the recursive improvement. Right. That's the thing. It's like the machine will be so smart. It'll just start fiddling with its machinery or its algorithm. And you know, all the arguments, they'll say, well, it can do a zillion simulations in a second. Well, it can, you know, it's costless to change its code. Well, it can experiment, right? You're going to hear all these things about recursive improvement. And so what's the answer to that?
It's just not based in reality, right? It's like, what's the answer to the assertion that, you know, the sun is blue, right? Like,
no, it's not.
These algorithmic processes are similarity comparisons. They're not, you know, extrapolating out far into the distance. And when you have, people don't understand this, people are kind of using preconceptions either from science fiction or from essentially like, you know, blog posts, fan fiction written 20 years ago based on understandings of machine learning that are completely different from the algorithms that are used today. The transformer architecture, which is currently the most popular, and also all of the alternatives that people are going to use to replace them, whether it's mixture of experts, whether it's state-space models and so on, all have this property that what they're measuring is similarity to some group of people, right? So if you're a top scientist, for example, you can duplicate, you can have more top scientists. That's the idea, at least, or at least free up more of their time. But the idea that this is something that is going to, you know, scale indefinitely is simply absurd. It's just not based in any form of reality.
Mm. And it won't scale indefinitely because you said something specific about the technology, the way the LLMs worked out, rather than what people were imagining was going to come before.
Both because of the existing algorithms, and some people argue that, you know, both people who are kind of on the doomer side, people who are more sane, argue that we're going to have to switch to different algorithms. Jan LeCun was arguing this the other day, and I think that he's correct. Eventually, people will have to make a breakthrough or, you know, maybe overcome a kind of political consensus or a kind of social consensus. As the saying goes, science progresses funeral by funeral. But certainly, if you believe in the far, far future that people are going to switch off of these similarity-based models, maybe go to something more like tree search algorithms, then sure. But that has very little evidence for occurring in the short to medium term. And, you know, you would actually have to make the affirmative argument for that rather than just conjecturing that the existing ways will get you.
Yeah, you're speaking at a very high level. You're a computer scientist, and so many people aren't going to know what you're talking about. So you're saying it's the specifics, the LLM, there's similarity models.
And right, but I think that many people get the intuition. Right? Many people, it's sort of like the midwit thing, except it's not even like most people, right? It's specifically like word cells. So normal people who go with common sense, they've looked at history, or at least, you know, a very elementary reading of history. They know that physics didn't go on forever. They knew that we got stuck at string theory. And it's the same is true for every other company, you know, the chemicals industry, right? Maybe there's some regulatory problems there, but fundamentally, the problems got harder. And you can look across
essentially every single field. People say the intelligence gets the chemicals don't help you consciously make more chemicals. The intelligence can help you make more. The intelligence is what makes the intelligence, right? So that's the logic. Programmers are going to become a lot more productive. They're going to become a lot better.
Right, but that is actually true for physics and for chemistry and so on. People develop tools. People develop time saves. Right, if people were using, you know, the physical models and the physical kind of measurement tools from like the 1800s, they'd make no progress.
Yeah, so it's inherently
on the specific question of intelligence. This is something that is based on a misnomer. it is this sort of word cell thing where they take two terms, conflate them, and that's where they draw their conclusion. What's fundamentally happening here is that there's two kinds of processes that people ascribe the word intelligence to. Mm. One is this kind of process of novel discovery, this process of deduction. And then the other is this process of essentially like scaling of definite, you've probably heard of Thiel's, definite and indefinite optimism. It's very similar to that, where people see tools that speed up the translation of ideas as ideas themselves. And this, on the kind of very elementary level, like just because you've changed a sentence from French to English doesn't give you new ideas. That's a very, very simple kind of overstatement, but people do not understand that this kind of translation of old material into new material is not science, or like it's nothing but a tool.
So the learned language model is just, fundamentally, it's just, you ever see, there was a South Park episode where they're making fun of Family Guy and they have the seals, and the seals are like putting random things together and making Family Guy cutaways, because the Family Guy cutaways are just a bunch of random nonsense. It's like, it's like Sex in the City, nuclear war, Brezhnev. And then they'll make like a cutaway of that. And then and they'll be like, the South Park is like, this is all that Family Guy is doing, right? And this is all that this is sort of what the LLM is doing, right? It's taking these words. It's like, if I say Brian Chu, I will say the next word will be is, and the next word will be that. And they're not making, is that the idea that you're just basically moving words around based on predictions of previous words? And this is fundamentally different than what you are doing or what I'm doing when we're, say, writing an essay?
I don't think all essays are original. Not all essays
are introducing new ideas. Yeah, some of them are people just putting words together. Right, yeah.
So I would say that people attribute intelligence to like more things than they should, or people have a conflation, right? All I'm asking for is not to conflate these two terms, right? When someone creates these very divergent theories, right? This kind of goes back to really the philosophy of startups. When people create these divergent, consensus challenging ideas, they're not doing the same thing as when they're repackaging an essay of, maybe one or two different people's writing. Those are not the same thing.
Yeah. And so the LLM is just repackaging. Is it repackaging? You reject the premise that it is like intelligence. So what's intelligence? Just a human, and a human who can
produce. Well, people use like IQ tests as an example, right? I think that this is the problem with the conflation. And the conflation is not just, it's not just doomers. There are many kind of normie people who make this conflation, right? The kind of recombination tasks, right, that you might see in an IQ test, like the Raven matrices, right? A very common grid-based IQ test. That is one thing that we mean when we say intelligence, but we also mean, the ability to create new ideas. And I don't want to pretend like this is just the doomers who are doing this. In fact, maybe they're downstream of other people. They're downstream of other people's mistakes. But the idea that you're going to take over the world, this kind of like political strategic thing, or as opposed to like do like reasonably well to like some sample of humans that have high performances on IQ tests. They're just not the same. And you see this in the real world as well. We're not ruled by Terence Tao. We're not in the Terence Tao dictatorship.
Yeah. Okay. So there's two questions sort of that the doomers present. There is like the idea of whether, and this is what you're focusing on, whether the specific technology is there. And the question of whether, we'll get there. And then we're all going to die because we're going to have an alignment problem of this intelligence that we're not going to understand. So I understand your first position, the technology is just not there. It's not going to be there for a while. Do you disagree in principle that if, that something like a Yudkowsky sort of fanfic could potentially happen if we have another model or another way of building intelligence?
Even if you have another way of developing intelligence, you it's still an engineering problem. You still have to, basically, I reject the premise that there's some, you know, secret sauce where we get infinite scaling. It's just not true. So you look at both, I talked just now about the kind of data constraints, the kind of similarity constraints, but there's another objection that's raised by the doomers, which is that, you know, what if scale is all you need? What if, you know, having someone who is similar to, let's say, top 1% of people, but is able to kind of repeat things at you know, 1,000 times the time, right? Generate that kind of interpolation, yeah. But that, you know, if you just have much more time, much more content with that same level of ability, then that will take over the world. Very simply put, that is not something you can actually do based on the existing resources. There is the secondary idea that really is not just the doomers, but, you know, very common idea in Silicon Valley and helps their marketing, that when a field invests in companies, that this turns into kind of underlying scientific innovation. And, you know, the causation is often backwards, but the thing that you see in history is that actually many times after these technologies are scaled, they cease to improve. Now, this isn't necessarily because they were funded. Maybe it was funded, most likely it was funded because they saw a dramatic increase in improvement, and then it kind of reverted to the mean. So you see this most famously with Google. PageRank did not significantly improve, even with the application of some machine learning technologies, and arguably it's gotten worse, mostly because people are doing SEO optimization, not because Google kind of made it worse. But although there are some claims of that as well. But you see this not just with Google, you see this with many of the tech giants in the past decade. You see this going back throughout history, chemical companies, drug companies, the famous Eroom's law, the backwards Moore's law, although that also has to do with regulation. You see this with U.S. Steel, right? Just think to yourself, like, how much did U.S. Steel becoming essentially a monopoly, becoming an immensely successful company, translate back into scientific development? So these people will make the case, which is completely detached from reality, that investment in machine learning will suddenly create this explosion of technological improvement, of improvement of the underlying way we do machine learning, and it lead to this discovery of these new models and so on and so forth. And I would just say, first of all, you know, the affirmative case should be on them, provide any kind of evidence for their claims, and they never do. And then secondly, there's not just no evidence for their claims, but there is active evidence against their claims, which is the historical precedent of essentially every company in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to frame it. You know, you could have... So I want to go back to something you said where you said, oh, you'll just have like a smart person at the 99th percentile. They will be... they'll be able to think faster. So like, yeah, you'll hear these things. Like I heard Sam Harris... would say, like, you are, like, if you just had the memory of a computer and the processing speed of a computer, just you or me as a human had the processing speed of a computer and we're a fairly intelligent person to begin with, we'd be superhuman. And that's all, and like, he made it sound like it was so easy to imagine. Like, you just that. Do you think that there's some kind of like fundamental trade off here, but like to think as well as like a human does, like a really smart human versus like doing it fast? Is there some kind of fundamental trade-off here, or do we not know, or what? Like, how do you answer that thing? What if we just made you, Brian Chu, 1,000 times faster?
Right. So that requires some kind of resource input, right? The main problem here is that people assume that this is going to happen for free, that you're just going to get indefinite scaling. Right now, the problem poses itself in two ways. One is resource constraints, something like data, something like compute. And two is just, even if you have enough compute, can you actually get there? Can you actually get these kind of complex systems of thoughts to work, right?
So yeah, but look how dumb we are. And we don't use that many resources. We're just a human. We eat a lot of, you know, food. Just we have something in our brains. We have some kind of way of interacting with the world that makes us very smart.
And yeah, for sure. So there are these, you know, people. This is a pushback on the kind of, you know, acceleration argument that I don't think is that I don't think is, you know, it's not correct for the right reasons, basically, that they'll say, you know, there's something fundamental about being human or something fundamental about biology. I don't think that that's true at all. It's more like you actually have to understand the underlying system. People like to take these shortcuts, right? People like to take these categories, or they like to take these broad generalizations, or they like to conflate terms and say, oh, this is where I'm going to plant my flag. I'm going to say that this category is either, you know, guaranteed or impossible. And really, you have to say it depends on the underlying technology. So on the underlying technology, when it comes to these sort of inference models, when it comes to transformers, for example, I would say that the constraint is with that technology that it makes it difficult for that to occur. Whereas, you could theoretically invent some kind of much better algorithm. There's two parts to this, right? There's looking at the underlying algorithms that exist and looking at the probability that a new algorithm is invented. So that's where I think that comes. Those arguments are put together. Now, some people who maybe agree with my end position, who I think are not coming at it from a kind of reality-based approach, is that they will say, you know, this is something fundamental about being human. This is something essential. And what is the argument for that? Well, one argument might just be, well, humans can do it now. They won't do it in the future. That is something that might be based on an eventual claim, right? That might be something that like turns out to be true at the end of the day, but doesn't really investigate why that's happening, right? So I think that, you know, it lacks the right reasoning, right? If you actually try to inspect the internal argument, it's not so good, but you know, ultimately it might be correct kind of by accident.
What's a transformer?
Right. So transformer is essentially the way we do machine learning for large language models right now. So something like ChatGPT, something like Anthropic's Claude, something like Google Gemini, all of these are based off of like slight variations of the transformer model.
Okay, so it's a model. It's not a machine. it's not like a chip.
Yeah, it's not you know, the power transformers, right? It's not like we're just taking the box off of the electricity poles, and then we're running our machine learning algorithms.
You mentioned resources. I saw some headline that ChatGPT uses like a huge portion of American energy consumption. Is that right?
No,
not a huge portion, but like way disproportionate to what it does.
This was very funny. I think this might have been something that I quote tweeted, which is some journalist said like it uses the equivalent of like 17,000 homes, and I just said like so approximately like 0.02% of the energy per user or per capita or whatever, right? So there will always be these headlines. There was these headlines with crypto that, you know, look how many, you know, millions of how much energy they're using, right? And that just comes with scale. Like if you serve a million users, or if you serve 100 million users, right? In the case of ChatGPT, that's going to use a lot of energy. Okay, you're doing 100 million
that's
of something.
But you mentioned resource, so that's not the resource constraint. It's not the literal energy, the electricity.
Right now, the energy is not a big deal. It's more so hardware. There's just a limited amount of chips, especially specialized chips in the world, and some people are trying to fix that with policy. Right now, in the future, people speculate that data will become more of a constraint as you're able to essentially run models that are able to process data more without using as many resources, or you'll simply have the resources to process that amount of data. That'll become a constraint. And then a third thing that might arise with regards to energy is that as these chips become more time efficient, There's a trade-off in design there, where they'll use maybe a similar amount of energy while becoming more time efficient, until eventually energy becomes more of a constraint, and then you'll have to optimize for that in the design process as well.
Mm. What's stopping us? It potentially is like just the number of chips, and there's just not enough of these silicon wafers. They're just TSMC, there's only one of them. Is that why? Is that going to prevent sort of the artificial intelligence from taking off?
Yeah. On one hand, there's two ways to look at this, right? You say prevent like it's otherwise an inevitable thing, and that's exactly the framing that I really despise. It's sort of this kind of like inevitability argument is just very silly because it reverses the null hypothesis. It's ahistorical. It's something that that's only believed by people who are just not attached to reality.
Your kind of evidence. We have this level of ChatGPT. It can, you know, write a Wikipedia page, or it can give me a third grade book report or a college report or something on ideas. And your basic assumption, and we have DALL-E and we have these things. Your basic assumption is like, we should not expect tons of, like, because everyone you talk to is like, just imagine a year. I thought I had Rocco Micek on last week on my podcast.
And yeah, he was just Rocco's a little bit more stable than some of these other folks. What I would say is that people assume that there's not much difference. I saw this graph. This is like such an stupid, and it's literally like a made up graph, right? It's not indicating any sort of real data. Going around where people are saying, you know, people put like Einstein and like the average human very close together. It's like, you're just an idiot if you think that. The more extreme comparison of saying like, oh, Einstein is like less different than like the average human, less different in terms of understanding of the world than like the average human, as the average human is to like a monkey. And that's just not true, right? There's just not that much understanding that was developed by the time, you know, like the average human rolled around. When people develop more, and people will have like very spurious measures of this, right? They'll use like the total number of like neurons or something.
But you think the distance between Einstein, Delta, and human is bigger than the human and the ape? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, of course, yes. Okay, of course.
If
you are understanding a physical model of the world, that's something that, to a very granular level, and not just understanding it, but developing this new system, right? Yeah. This is something that the average human is not going to be able to do, not even close.
They can't even get the concept of, you can't even explain to them theory of relativity in a dumb way. You're right. I like this. This is so anti-egalitarian.
Right. This is one of the other assumptions, right? I saw this other post. It's just idiotic of like, the train will not stop at human station. That's their model. It's like, what is human station exactly, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what is it that's so similar? And this is one thing that they kind of create a circular argument around, because they'll say there's not that much of a neuron difference. There's not that much of a total neuron difference between, you know, Einstein and the average human. And then they'll say, you know, therefore, as we're like increasing the total amount of operations, you know, which they kind of analogize, even this comparison is kind of silly, but let's take the assumption that you can analogize, you know, compute operations in a machine learning network to the neural difference. Really, what that should tell you is that their assumption is wrong. Because they're saying, you know, look, there's not that much difference between the neural, the number of neurons in the average human in Einstein, right? And they're saying, therefore, you know, changing the number of neurons by a little bit will get you from a human to Einstein. Whereas, you know, that should be a proof by contradiction. That should tell you that, you know, this assumption that the neurons are what matters is just stupid.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean the argument here is that there's such a big, like, even so, maybe ChatGPT is as smart as a average college student. Like, I buy that. Like, the average college student couldn't write it.
So this is something that's interesting. They gave some form of IQ test to all of these models. And once again, you know, there's huge variation in abilities. IQ tests are not, you know, are not indicative of a machine learning model's ability to generalize to other human tasks, so on and so forth. All caveats aside, someone did this experiment, and I think like Claude Opus had like 101 IQ, and then on this test, and then ChatGPT or GPT-4 had I think like 80, 85 or 86, and then the rest were below that.
Mm-hmm. So they went backward. They went backwards. It was the first one with the 101 before ChatGPT. Was ChatGPT supposed to be an improvement?
No. So Claude Opus is the model by Anthropic. It's a different company.
Okay. So these guys, so they're at 100 in IQ tests. Although that might, are they trained on IQ tests? Like I don't know
about Claude Opus. Yeah. I think there was an article where OpenAI did a similar experiment, and they were talking about a specific genre of IQ tests that they had removed from their sample. Maybe there were some other IQ tests in the sample. None of this is public. Yeah. But they said on like some other post that they did an IQ test that was not in the sample, and then they got some results.
Yeah. So yeah, they passed the LSAT, they passed the MCAT, and that's interesting. So
yeah, these kind of like knowledge lookup tests, they seem to be better at. So this you is think some kind yeah, of, getting, this is a kind of asymmetry.
Right. So getting to 100, I mean, maybe we're there arguably, but you're saying to get to 140, like these are gaps. These are not, you know, these are step, you know, 120, 140. These are completely different things. And you think that we just because we got to 100 now or 102 or whatever, we shouldn't think that like getting to 103, we shouldn't see getting to 140.
Especially because the quantity of data available is an uneven distribution. Right.
So they had to eat the whole internet, all the text in the world, they had to eat, right? Basically to do this or a lot of it.
Yeah. Not all information is public, but we're talking about, we're talking about like large fractions of the internet.
Yeah. 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 And so you needed that. And is there anything like, have there been serious developments as far as the underlying algorithm, or is it just been eating more and more data?
There's like promise. There are some things that are like quote unquote promising, and how they measure that is that they essentially take existing take unoptimized versions of the existing model. So the transformer architecture, right? They take a transformer and they say, you know, essentially they try to set up a fair fight. So what I mean by fair fight is that there are all of these very specific kind of engineering or like slight adjustments that people make to the transformer model in order to make it slightly more efficient, both in kind of in conjunction with the underlying hardware, in the way that they actually implement the operations of that model in a way that's particularly fast given the underlying hardware, so on and so forth. And they say, okay, let's take these micro optimizations out. Let's just try to give, once again, a quote-unquote fair fight between this model, this unoptimized version of a transformer, and this new alternative. And they found that the new alternative can beat the kind of fair fight version of the transformer slightly. And I should say that many of these, I was talking about earlier about these kind of fundamental constraints based on like similarity and based on kind of next token prediction. All of those apply to like the major competitors that we're seeing, whether it's switch transformers, whether it's state-based models. Those constraints are also true of those alternatives. They're not kind of huge leaps in kind of a completely different crazy direction. They're, you know, restructurings that are promising. I want to be optimistic about this. I want to be optimistic about the good people who are doing research on this. But, you know, like I said right at the beginning, like I quoted from Robin Hanson, you shouldn't expect the problems to remain just as easy as you're getting better at them.
Yeah. Yeah. So this, I think you're right. I mean, this, you pointed out, this has been sort of a pessimistic conversation just about how much sort of sounds like it's just about how AI doesn't work. But really, we're just arguing with the people who think it's going to have an IQ of a million and enslave us in like 2 years. Right.
And so that's exactly. And I think it's a reason to be optimistic about AI, because at the end of the day, AI is a tool. That tool is getting a lot more useful. And, you know, I use it every day. I use it to generate a lot of the graphics that I use in the think tank. I use it to generate a lot of just a lot of resources in general. This is something that I've been doing, and I found that Claude was much better at than GPT-4 is kind of translating. So I have a lot of articles written from a kind of journalistic tone, you know, to put it bluntly, kind of optimized for clicks and optimized for subscriptions and so on, that I want to rewrite in a think tank style to be much more neutral, to try to stay less into controversy and focus more on the technical aspects and where it's relevant for policymakers. And doing this kind of translation, doing this kind of change in tone is something that's very useful. Right. And that's something that, once again, you're using AI as a tool for.
Yeah. I had a paper where I did some text analysis of when I was doing academic work, some text analysis of some UN resolutions. It used the Leighton-Dirichlet allocation, you know, this kind of method of like predicting words. It classifies words based
on. Can I say that again?
It's called Leighton-Dirichlet allocation. Do you know this kind of algorithm? Anyway, it's not important. If it's not important.
I'm just trying to remember because I see these things pass by. Sorry, go on.
So it's related to the LLM, because of my little bit of background in this, I sort of get how the LLMs work. How does the DALL-E, how do these picture stuff work? Because you're not just predicting the next thing. What are you doing when you're making a video or a picture with AI?
So we have a lot less visibility, essentially, into how DALL-E works. There was a kind of more recent breakthrough with diffusion models, which is what stable diffusion is. It's in the name, where they kind of break down the images in a more in an increasingly more kind of granular level, right? They'll have essentially what a version of the image that they generate that has much broader strokes, and then they'll kind of go in on details on each part and so on, and that's how they represent it in the network. But on DALL-E, I think there's so I've focused less on this because quite frankly because it's kind of no one is arguing that DALL-E is the part that's
really?
Going
to
take
DALL-E
over the world.
DALL-E seems to me a lot more impressive. DALL-E seems to, I don't know anything about this, but DALL-E to me, making a video or a movie, it seems a lot more impressive than.
Impressive from a kind of useful, from a kind of utility perspective, right? That it's a very powerful tool. And I agree. You know, I am impressed by it. I'm very happy. I'm happy to pay $20 a month for it, you know? And you're in the situation where, in fact, you're right that there's sort of an excessive focus on the language models, especially on these kind of online debates. But yeah,
I'm not saying that necessarily.
If you're kind of returned to sanity, right? If you're returned to sanity and you're looking at all of these from a kind of economic perspective, yeah, it might as well be. It may very well be that DALL-E is a more powerful tool.
The conceptual core of this. The fact that a computer to me, like, so you'd have to know something about the underlying technology and sort of how fundamental, you know, is what it's doing. But to me, I'm not thinking about the economic impact or whatever, but just to be taking a bunch of words, moving them around, predicting them, is one thing. Making a picture, like drawing it, like that seems to me insane. That boggles my mind. But you're telling me for some reason that the people who think that AI is going to kill us all, they're more impressed with LLM. And is that true? And if so, is there some conceptual core to the LLM that makes it potentially more likely to foam than DALL-E is, to be more likely to blow up?
I mean, that's their perspective. Yeah. There's some noise around around the new video model Sora that, you know, I think OpenAI had this blog called like visual video models as physics engines or something like that, where they say it gives it an understanding of like physics. I think that if I were to kind of play the doomer and try to steelman their argument, they would say that, you know, the language model is more threatening because it shows more ability to plan, right? An image is not necessarily a kind of sequence of actions that you would take to to take over the world. Like if you ask an LLM, like give me like a non-RLHF, maybe the RLHF makes doesn't answer. But if it's, you know, not RLHF to refuse to answer, then it might go basically like here are some steps that you would take towards taking over the world. And of course they wouldn't work. But, you know, it shows more evidence of, like, quote-unquote planning.
Show you pictures of how to take over. I mean, DALL-E, it's really weird. It's like, you know, draw a baseball bat with the name Richard on it. And, like, it just doesn't get it. Like, you think, like, a person would get it. It draws, like, an R and, like, an X and, like, a symbol. And it's like, what is going on in this thing, right? And
I'm looking at the wrong places. Have you seen the one where they try to get it to spell? No, this is ChatGPT, I think. That they try to get it to spell Honda in like ASCII characters.
What is ASCII characters?
Basically, you know, like those early internet like designs where they use like the text characters to make art. Do you know what I talk about? Like emojis.
But I guess it doesn't matter. Yeah. So what happens?
Basically, it's very hard to get it to spell out Honda. They eventually do it, but like very painstakingly, like one letter at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you believe that they're justified in being more interested in LLM as a fundamental technology of intelligence than DALL-E, or do you think that that's just them being irrational?
I think their entire model of technological development is wrong. Maybe it's like slightly less wrong, but it's just, you know, moving deck chairs on the Titanic, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be wrong either way. Maybe it's like more obviously wrong. Like I kind of. At this point, I think like every doomer they bring to every doomer argument that they actually like try to make in front of like normies or in front of like lawmakers is like a net benefit to me. But like I'd especially like to see one that's like based off of DALL-E. So most of the time, like these doomer organizations will send people to like complain about deepfakes and stuff. And there are some, like, honestly, like, the deepfake concerns I take more seriously. And they're resolved through, you know, normal law enforcement, right? But, you know, if they gave their honest, actual, you know, internet arguments, that's the thing with me. I don't need to give a different argument for the internet as opposed to for, like, normal people. It's the same argument. It's you know, it's not hard to understand at all. Maybe once I get to some of the technical reasons why they're wrong, it's harder to understand. But the kind of, you know, broad strokes idea is the same. They have to, like, they have to pretend they're, like, very concerned about, like, misinformation or racism or, you know, automation. They're just so much more dishonest. And you know, maybe if I had to be more dishonest, you know, I really don't think I could bring myself to it. That's the thing. Nah. But, you know, like you can imagine a world where, like, there are actually, like, other technologies that I think it's, like, harder to make the case to the public for. You know, Bitcoin is one example, right? Or, like, crypto in general. It's kind of, like, not obvious to most normal people that, like, Bitcoin is a net good. Even if I do think Bitcoin is a net good, I'm not sure the same arguments from an intellectual level would work on a political level. But, you know, when the benefits are just so overwhelmingly positive, like AI, and where the concerns, I mean, like, some of the normie concerns, I actually do, like, think that you know, you need to take effort to learn and understand their concerns very well.
Do you think AI alignment is worth working on at all? Like, do you think Leon Eschenbrenner, I don't know if you've seen his work, but
I met him. We all met at Adventures. I mean, I don't think like the motivation is right. I think that, you know, kind of experiments on trying to understand the underlying technology better is probably a net good, right? Maybe it's like an opportunity cost, right? Maybe if you were just, you know, doing he just joined some other team, that would actually be better. But in terms of, like, these things aren't hurting anyone, right? If you're just conducting experiments on kind of getting these and these
he's a smart guy, opportunity cost for him and people like him is pretty big. Is he helping, you think? Do you think it's worth hedging in case Eliezer is actually a prophet? No,
like, you know, in this kind of time frame, no. In like the far future, you know, like many iterations of kind of scientific progress, you know, really like Max Weber says, like the slow boring of politics. I think science can be similar, especially kind of like developed, established science, which we see in most other fields, right? You know about this. You were in academia.
I think Leopold would say
after a few cycles of AI winter, and then, you know, we get to the next thing, and then, you know, we get to the next thing again, and so on and so forth. That could be something that becomes useful, but or even just as a kind of like as a kind of systems engineering thing in the present. There are some applications of it, right? If you just want a kind of low compute layer supervising a high compute layer for some reason, I could see, you know, organizational reasons why you would want that, or just kind of like practical resource constraints. But in terms of like the doomer scenario, it's just, this is the thing that I realized that like the more I looked into it, that, you know, usually when you're looking into politics, you get a respect for people as you really go into their arguments. I think especially in the case of these kind of like moral fights, right? As you go more into the philosophical understanding of it, maybe not for you actually, you know, maybe you just start to hate these people.
No, I start to hate them. My view is the more I look at most people's political views, I would have thought for you too, the more I'm like, no, there's not much.
I don't know. It's like they start with some axioms. I don't really blame people for being emotional, especially if they're like kind of honest about it. You know, you just gain an understanding. No, not necessarily that you think they're like, oh, they're like suddenly, you know, savants, that they're suddenly geniuses. But I think you get to the kind of base, like emotional core of a lot of people's political preferences. Yeah. You know, maybe I still think that they're wrong on some of the facts,
having an emotional core that's driving everything is not, to me, admirable. I agree there's emotional core. There could be an intellectual core.
This doesn't mean that I think they're like right about reality, but you at least kind of get how the logic works.
Okay.
Right? The doomers are just like, the more you kind of look into their logic and like how they try to like connect one argument into another, the more you realize that it's this sort of cargo cult that they just love. This is something that like really just really grinds my gears, is that they just love analogies. They hate getting to the actual definition. They hate discussing the underlying thing. That they're always like, oh, do you want to talk about like evolution as an analogy? Oh, do you want to talk about like the fucking paperclip optimizer, something that's based off of an understanding of machine learning that's, you know, far outdated, that's very distant, that is like completely ignorant of modern kind of customization techniques, RLHF, SBT, so on, right? Or even worse, like oh, imagine if you just had like smarter aliens. Like this is already making an assertion that is just false. And this is the pattern, right? The pattern is like, make an obviously false comparison, draw a correct conclusion about the thing you made a false comparison to, and then like proudly proclaim that you've solved the original problem. Anytime you hear anyone try to like throw an analogy at you like that, as if it's like actual evidence, not as in something that is, you know, giving you the outline of a future argument, but as an argument in and of itself, right? That is something you should be highly suspicious of.
Yeah, that's interesting. We talked about AI. It's going to do cool things. I'm with you on, you know, I don't know. I think we might have, you know, you've moved me a bit here.
And I should say I'm optimistic about the economic effects. I think everyone's lives, or at least almost everyone's lives, are going to be much better.
Standard arguments against like the other things, like racism, automation. These are all those stupid arguments. Racism and it's going to take our jobs is always a bad argument, right? But these are the things.
The automation thing is interesting because it is sort of a cost and benefit thing, right? You can find like one person, you know, you can find like a specific person who was made worse off by the Industrial Revolution. Sure.
Yeah, this is Ludditism. It's the simple argument against Ludditism against all kinds.
But in the context of like politics, what I would say is like, you know, just count, line up the votes, count the votes, you know, way more people will be benefiting from AI. You know, we already have 100 million users of ChatGPT, right? This is going to be a real constituency. It's going to be like banning the mobile phone.
Yeah, that's good. So the politics of this, this might be a question of whether your thing is necessary. My understanding of politics puts a lot of stock in inertia. Both of my books really are about inertia, about American foreign policy, and then about sort of the civil rights regime, about inertia, and just sort of developments in a slow and sort of unpredictable ways. You take this view seriously, that it's an optimistic story for AI, because software has traditionally not been regulated. It's sort of hard to regulate, and there's not a nuclear regulatory commission. So I always assume that we're not going to do anything on AI. The regulations are going to be half-hearted. There's a bunch of TikTok they might actually ban or force a sale, but they haven't done anything that much to social media.
That's not related to AI. That's related to Chinese ownership. Instagram Reels.
Right. Exactly what I'm saying. So I'm saying we have this long held sort of thing where practice where government doesn't really regulate software, and that includes social media. And so are there reasons to be worried that we'll strangle AI?
Yeah, there's three main reasons. Mm-hmm. One is the kind of politics of emergency. You saw this with COVID. You mm-hmm. saw
yeah.
basically how much the Constitution doesn't matter if all of the people agree the Constitution doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. This is what I hear from a lot of people here, that and I agree with them to a large extent, that code is speech. Imagine banning code. That would be insane. There's a agency right now that's trying to the NTIA, I forget what it's called. This is something that I'm working on right now, that's trying to get comment on whether they should ban open source models. And there are serious, very, very well funded, basically like Doomer organizations that are trying to push this through. Now, at the end of the day, there is a very real possibility that they try to do this, that, it goes to the Supreme Court. They say, no, this is an obvious violation of the First Amendment. And then on that specific threat, we're safe. Is that guaranteed? I would say that it's actually not guaranteed. And I would look at both COVID as a precedent, and also some of the stuff you write in your book, right? The origins of woke, that there was originally an understanding of civil rights, that it was going to be, we weren't going to discriminate against whites or against other groups, and then this just got completely ignored. Mm. And I think that it's with something like the First Amendment, where there is a long held precedent, I do think that this will be one of the more difficult or some of the kind of like more tail end threats, right? Well, how I would look at it is that there's sort of a distribution where this is one of the most dangerous threats, right? I think that if this is approved, that you essentially don't live in a free country anymore, you don't have the First Amendment anymore. But it's also, for that same reason, actually, it's also very difficult, because it would require going through the politics of emergency and getting enough people to agree that you should overturn the First Amendment, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you said three reasons, didn't you? That this might be.
So that's one. Number two is the kind of normal political concerns. I think that the normal political concerns actually matter. And quite frankly, if I'm talking about people speaking in front of Congress, if I'm talking about people who are having direct interactions with policymakers, that's a much more immediate threat, because they will look at some of these models and they will essentially try to try to get them to agree with their pre-existing ideology, whether it's something like race or disinformation, so on, kind of like the grab bag of existing political interests. And I actually documented this already affecting existing language models, because Google published a paper on Gemini, part of which describes how they went through like the quote-unquote fine-tuning. This is the ideological biasing that I reported out, that I think you've talked about on Twitter, that essentially, many people have seen this, that caused it to eventually refuse to generate images of white people, to otherwise, in the kind of text version of Gemini, when you're asking it questions, have a very kind of, left-wing ideology. This was done through a secondary training process. And at the end of this training process, or at the end of the paper describing this training process. They say, you know, the responsible AI safety team or the responsible AI team was put together according to the recommendations of the Biden executive order and the UK government declaration. And so you already see this kind of sub-legal government policy, right? This is something that people employed by the government are doing in interacting with these companies, even if it's not, you know, a law that passes through Congress that has changed what these language models will look like. And to my opinion, to a very, very detrimental level. And in fact, according to some objective evaluations, it also makes it, you know, worse at answering factual questions, right? As you might expect from someone or something of that ideology. So that's number two, is kind of traditional political interest. And third is the crackdown on hardware, which I think that is less kind of, quite frankly, has less implications on the kind of broader freedoms that normal Americans have, right? That is more of a kind of economic central planning thing, but less of a kind of, you know, abolishment of the First Amendment, but is something where it will have significant economic consequences. Like you look at the kind of slowdowns caused by cost restraints in an open market, right? That'll be nothing compared to if a crackdown on hardware happens and this becomes something that is heavily restricted and controlled by the federal government.
Yeah. Let me ask you a basic question. So open source, Biden open source model, is the ChatGPT, is the model open source?
No. It's very funny. Many people, most famously Elon, have complained about this. You know, there's this, I think he had this tweet that like, oh, you should change your name to closed AI. And he's kind of right. ChatGPT is not an open source model. You'll never, or I don't know about never, but right now you can't read the code online. This is as opposed to something like Llama, where the code and weight is online. You can basically download it and use it, right? You can use it and you can modify it using, you know, normal machine learning techniques and so on and so forth. That's what people mean by open source.
And the role of hardware, if I had OpenAI's algorithm, I would not be able to run it on a normal computer. Would I need a super something computer?
So essentially there's two phases to this, right? There's training and there's inference. So the advantage of a lot of open source models where their weights are released is that the weights are kind of the product of this first training process. And the first training process is immensely expensive. It's the main barrier for most startups and one of the reasons why, you know, why NVIDIA stock price is so high, in hardware right now.
Is that just like having the predictions, like having a matrix of predictions? Is that what all that is?
It's not quite a matrix of predictions. It's a matrix of essentially that directs how input is processed through the network. I really don't like the analogies that most people use to this. So I'm just going to try to explain it best I can on the kind of, you know, real level. Essentially, each of these machine learning models require something to compare their like progress to, right? To judge how effectively they are predicting the next token, essentially how effectively they're giving an answer, and to improve itself if they're not doing very well. That's why the training process happens. So the training process happens. The training process consists of taking all of this data that you hear about, like kind of going in to the LLM, right? And essentially taking a batch of it, passing it through the LLM, so running the LLM on it, see what it outputs, and kind of measuring the difference between what you thought it would output and what it actually did output, and then kind of using a technique called backpropagation, update the network so that it better predicts the next token, so that it better matches the input text. So this is, you know, a massive amount of data, and in order to process all of that data, a massive amount of operations as well. And
so the operations requires a lot of hardware to do the operations, or just to make the original thing. Okay, so what I'm getting at is, if the open AI code was fully available, but the government seized all hardware, we would not be able to have ChatGPT.
Yeah. So there are ways to make it more. You can run models. You can run what people call inference, which is basically asking it to answer a new question without actually updating the model itself. You can run that on sort of normal hardware.
Right? So I could run today's ChatGPT, but I can't update it.
It's a matter of quantity, not quality. Theoretically, you could gather enough like normal CPUs and run the algorithm on it, right? Both either training or inference. Okay. So but it's just much less efficient.
I just have to buy enough computers. So once the code is out there, what I'm getting at is, once the code is out there, is making code open source like a defense against government takeover? Because
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And so you can, if one day somebody gets the tragedy would be somebody takes over open AI and like destroys the code, right? If somebody has the code out there, we'd at least have ChatGPT up to the level of 2024, and we could run it, and we could have the technology. And this applies to other things too.
There's a slight caveat to that, which is that when most people say the code, they just mean the underlying algorithm, not necessarily the results of the training. So the results of the training, the kind of configuration of each of the numbers in this data or in this model, is usually called the weights, right? So the weights are the results of running the code on all of the training data and then updating the network, right? Updating the weights. The weights are what allows... Or the weights are the thing that is updated to make a machine learning model better predict the output.
Yeah. So yes. So we can. So it sounds like we can have. There are steps we could take to at least protect what we have so far. You have an algorithm. It's just a bunch of code.
Yeah. Releasing the algorithm and the weights. That would be a coup de grace. That would be wonderful.
Yeah. You would need hard, and the government could come down on hardware, and try to destroy progress. Which you would need for that. Not only on that one, but on potentially other kinds of technology, other kinds of models and ways to get intelligence.
So the specialized, the problem that you could see is that as specialized hardware becomes more and more efficient compared to normal hardware, a normal CPU, which it already is, right? It's already much more efficient than a normal CPU for, basically technical reasons, the ability to run more of a simple process in parallel, basically. And models kind of update themselves. The way people run models kind of changes to reflect that. Then they do become very difficult to run locally. Now there are some experiments with existing open source models that allow you to run them on a kind of normal Apple chip or a kind of normal Windows processor, a normal kind of Microsoft processor, right, or an Intel processor, and gets okay results. Usually, there's some decrease in performance. But yeah, it's a matter of marginal cost, right? It's a matter of if you take this section of high performing hardware out of the market, there's always going to be, well, not always, I guess, but there will be substitutes in any kind of realistic scenario of this happening.
Yeah,
and so the substitutes might be less efficient, but the marginal cost of having more LLMs running increases, or the marginal value of having more LLMs running increases. So people will use the existing hardware to run the LLMs.
Yeah. So let's shift to the things you're actually most excited about with AI. Is there something that people are missing that it's going to be able to do besides create porn, answer questions, tutor kids, make movies? People have thought about all that stuff. Well, what do you see as sort of the benefit here?
Yeah, accelerating software writing. I think that like this is very funny. It kind of goes to kind of nostalgia factor in me. So maybe this is just my personal bias, but like a lot of writing code is like boilerplate. Like you have a few ideas, there's a few things that you do to kind of direct those ideas that kind of expresses what you want to get done. And then there is a lot of boilerplate. And this is something that current levels of AI can do, right? Copilot, ChatGPT to some level. I had a front-end bug in the Alliance for the Future website. And then I corrected it. And I remember messaging the internal organization and saying, you know, guess how I fixed the front end bug. And of course it was with GPT-4. So, you know, this is something that I'm already very excited for. That's the first thing that comes to mind. Something that this is less this is not really a kind of out of left field take, but biotechnology I'm very excited for. I think like that's always something where there people put a lot of hope in, because you know the kind of payoff of having a healthier, longer lives, or curing these dangerous diseases or other problems that people might have. These are things that you know are very heartwarming for good reason. I don't think the emotion is a bad thing. It's correct, you know.
Yeah. So cool. Okay. So exciting. So the upshot here is don't be like nuclear power. Don't destroy.
Yeah, exactly. The NRC, NEPA, we have precedents for where this happened, yeah. Right? And for some kind of specific reasons, right? Mostly because software is speech. It's harder, but that will not stop people from trying, as you very well know. And this is something that I want to emphasize, that what we saw with Google and what we saw with Gemini is a kind of sub-legal coordination, right? That, you know, the government will say, here are things that we recommend. And, you know, if you don't follow our recommendations, we maybe won't directly say that's why we're retaliating. But, you know, yeah. You see what's happening with Musk. You see what's happening with a lot of these other companies.
Is there any lever or any kind of pressure to make OpenAI release its algorithm? Is there anything going on as far as that? Are they still in the Musk lawsuit? Yeah, he's trying to sue them.
But not really. It's a private company, and I do think like there is going too far when it comes to like I am a huge supporter of open source. I think that the people working on open source are doing God's work. But at the end of the day, like, if someone doesn't want to open source their weights and they don't want to open
but it seems like this knowledge is out there, right? I mean, like, how close are other models to ChatGPT? It seems like a lot of people can do this perhaps, or they're close to it.
Yeah, it depends on the benchmark. So I would say that, yeah, Mistral is already kind of better than GPT-3-ish, I would say, on most benchmarks. And there's imagine, there's a lot of dispute over this.
Yeah, the cat's out the bag, at least for basic.
That's not the point I was going to make. I agree with that point, but the point I was going to make is that, you know, all these companies want to like exaggerate the benchmarks in their favor, right? They want to pretend like their model, they want to focus on the things that they're best at and kind of brush the things that they're worse at under the rug. So it is kind of hard to settle on what benchmark is the best for comparing these. But I would say that Mistral is not, from a kind of, you know, holistic level, I would say that Mistral is not that many generations behind, and they're probably the leading open source model on a lot of these benchmarks that I'm seeing. And what else I would say is, returning to the other point, machine learning, a lot of these techniques are published out in the open, right? Everyone, you can all read the Transformer paper on Arxiv. And a lot of this data is kind of already out there. Some people are saying that in the longer term, or even in the medium term, you know, Meta might have an advantage, or Google might have an advantage, because they have their own, you know, they have their own databases, right? And that might be true for some more kind of specific tasks, right? There's kind of AlphaFold, which is the protein folding task. So that's true in some specific areas. But in terms of language models, that's less the case, because there's just so much text. I think that competition is alive and well. I welcome it. I don't agree with Thiel that like competition is bad, right? I want to see it. I want to see all of these guys succeed.
Excellent. So what can people do to reach you? How can they help? Just plug a line for the
future. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I was kind of excited to talk about kind of political strategy because you know a lot about this, you know, especially about the legal pathways, and you know we both are interested in public choice and so on and so forth. But that's unfortunate. The best way to help is by donating affuture.org/donate. And you can also reach out to me at chow@affuture.org. And both of those links, I mean, it's the same website, have two Fs. This is a problem that we've run into. It's AF Future, future with a second F, other than the AF that came before it. You know, and you can see a lot of our materials there. We feature a lot of articles, including people like Tyler Cowen, Mark Andreessen, Tim Lee. And yeah, we're very excited for any kind of comment that you might have.
Wait, so is this like a blog? You have Andreessen and Tyler and these other people there?
Yeah, so this is it's a selection of essays or articles from other sites.
Gotcha.
So we have kind of summaries, and then we link back to the original.
Yeah.
Basically, it's like a cream of the crop of what we want to highlight in the community.
Yeah. Well, this one was, I mean, we can go back to the political stuff another time. We could have another conversation. I think just talking about AI and alignment.
Yeah,
and
for sure. This will be my, this will be the podcast I link to when it comes to my unfiltered takes on the doomers. Because for a while, look, I'm still friends with a lot of EAs. Yeah. I still agree with them on drug acceleration. It's funny because they're all they're accelerationists on drugs, they're accelerationists on YIMBY, on building new stuff. Yeah. I miss that EA. You guys should come back. And I still know some people who work on those issues. But EA more broadly, get back to your roots. Be more optimistic about the world. Yeah. Look at the dumb shit politicians get up to and start being angry about that instead.
Yeah. Have you talked
to the EA I miss?
Have you met a laser?
No, I don't think so. There's some event. There was some SF party that supposedly he was at, but I didn't see him there.
Mm, and you were at. Okay, yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk. We were both at the Manifest conference last year, but okay. I was just curious because you were talking about your relationships.
Yeah, I'm probably nothing's finalized yet, but I'll probably be at Manifest this year, so it'll be interesting.
Okay, cool. Yeah, maybe hopefully I'll be there too. Okay, Brian, it's been great. Until next time, we'll put all the links, of course. Yeah, we'll put all the links, of course, in the show notes so people can find them there. Okay, bye, Brian.
See ya.